Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Great to be back here on the Monday edition on the early side here of Balance of Power on Bloomberg Radio, satellite radio, channel 121. We're live on Bloomberg Originals now, you know, as well as YouTube. Of course, you can always find us by searching Bloomberg Business News Live. That goes for all of our shows from New York and Washington throughout the day. It is one of the coolest things that we have going here on YouTube with Google earnings in mind later this week. So here's the state of play. On a cloudy Monday in Washington, it's kind of quiet around here, to be honest, even though lawmakers are still in town. This is it. House and Senate are in session, and soon they'll all be gone. This is it for the House this week. The Senate's supposed to work through the end of the month, even though they're being threatened that they might stay here in overtime to deal with some nominees. And the president heads to Scotland on Friday. By the time that happens, dog days of summer kick in here in Washington, right? It's just us and the tourists. And I bet they'll still be talking about Jeffrey Epstein. I haven't talked about this at all on the air. I just didn't know if it was really a Bloomberg story. And we were kind of asking people should take this seriously, whether it was tabloid. The president certainly has been taking it seriously. And boy, what a situation over the weekend. Happy 6 months, by the way. Do you have a Truth Social account? I just asked Nancy Cook this. Or do you look at the posts on the terminal? Because it is one of many hundreds of inputs on the Bloomberg terminal. And he was busy. More than 24 posts last night. You go back earlier in the weekend. Wow, the president writes, time flies. Today is that 6 month anniversary of my second term. Importantly, it's being hailed as one of the most consequential periods of any president. In other words, he writes, we got a lot of good and great things done, including ending numerous wars of countries not related to us other than through trade and or in certain cases, friendship. 6 months, Donald Trump says, is not a long time to have totally revived a major country. The posts veered into some dark and odd places over the course of the weekend, culminating with the 24 that went up on Sunday night, including a video of Barack Obama being arrested in the Oval Office. The conventional wisdom here in Washington today is that the president's trying to change the subject. But of course, we turn to Nancy Cook at times like this, Bloomberg political correspondent, senior national political correspondent who covered the first Trump term, the campaign, and now here in 2.0. It's great to see you, Nancy. Welcome back. We're overdue. If you posted all of that stuff over the weekend, wouldn't people be saying, is Nancy all right? And so is the president all right? What is generating all of this, if not an effort to change the subject?
Well, I think that, right, it's just really an effort to change the subject. And the White House has been looking to change the subject on the Jeffrey Epstein story really for the last like week and a half.
Yeah.
And you have to remember that this is a sort of slate of conspiracy theories that President Trump, you know, used during the campaign. Oh, you know, people are covering up things with Jeffrey Epstein. So he is someone who perpetuated this. Mm-hmm. So did his FBI director, Kash Patel.
Yeah.
So this is like one of the many conspiracy theories that animates the MAGA base that helped him rise to power. But now he, now there's a question about his own relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Is his name in the files?
Right.
Now he's really trying to redirect the attention. And there's been a fracturing with the MAGA base on it.
Sure.
Who wants to see, you know, they want to see more. But we've seen Trump really since Friday go hard and try to change the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the Office of National Intelligence, you know, release some documents related to Russiagate on Friday, which I was told, you know, by sources was an effort to change the narrative.
Hmm.
We saw Trump, you know, posting a bunch of things to Truth Social. He's really just doing what he usually does, which is throwing a bunch of things at the wall and seeing what will stick to actually change the subject.
Well, you see the pictures they're showing on YouTube while we're talking of them together in the good old days, the party pics and all that kind of stuff. It's clearly not working. But it is a president and an individual who has changed the subject just by way of blunt force. if he continues this, do we find a new shiny object? Maybe we get to August 1st, start talking about trade deals again.
Well, I think that, you know, they're trying to talk about the economy, or I think that another way he tried to change the subject last week was by, you know, some of his aides floating he was going to fire Jerome Powell on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And then at the White House, he said, oh, of course not. I'm not going to do that. I mean, really, they're looking for any chance they get. Mm-hmm. I'll be curious to see how long this particular storyline has legs. I mean, it doesn't seem to be ending. There's just, you know, there was the Wall Street Journal story about that letter that Trump sent Jeffrey Epstein. The New York Times has done a series of stories. Like, I think there's just going to be a drumbeat of stories about what's actually in the files and what that relationship looks like.
Now that we're seeing the big front pagers, like you said, he's suing the Wall Street Journal, or at least said he would. I don't know that that's been filed. He was going to sue Rupert Murdoch. News Corp owns the Wall Street Journal. Then the New York Times shows up with a big dive on their relationship, how friendly they were, and for how long. You've been in this business for a minute. When you see a scandal, if I can use that word, when you see a story like this reaching these proportions, what does that tell you is coming next? Does it just keep burning?
I think it's just going to keep burning. And it's funny, you know, again, like, it's just, it's ironic because he did use these conspiracy theories to rise to power.
Yeah.
But now it's funny that his White House is saying, oh, we just want to talk about our policy wins.
Yeah.
You know, we just want to talk about immigration or the tax bill. Like, they're trying to pivot back. One of the additional ways they're trying to pivot back is to talk about the policy stuff.
My poll numbers, he writes, within the Republican Party and MAGA have gone up significantly since the Jeffrey Epstein hoax was exposed by the radical left Democrats and just plain troublemakers, he writes in a separate post. They have hit 90, 92%, 93%, and 95% in various polls. Have you seen any poll showing an approval rating in the 90s like that?
No, I mean, I do think that he does have a higher approval rating if you ask Republican voters than just sort of general voters. It is higher. I think it's more like in the 70s or 80s. But again, that depends on the issue. But, you know, his approval rating is, you know, more of what a typical president would be at this point.
He's threatening to block the stadium deal for the Washington Commanders, which was known for some time as Washington's football team. Remember when that's what we called it in public? The Washington whatevers, he writes, should immediately change their name back to its original name. He says there's a big clamoring for this. He went on to write further in a separate post, my statement on the Washington football team has totally blown up, but only in a very positive way. When you see posts like this, does this bring us back to the old whoever spoke to him last line? Was he on the phone with a friend that got him going on the football team? How did this become the story?
It could be. You know, you have to, one thing about covering Trump for a long time is he there's so much input from him.
Yeah.
And so he watches TV constantly, regardless of what his aides will say. Oh, he doesn't. He always has the TV on.
Uh-huh.
You know, he is always sort of on social media, checking it out. He also is an avid reader of newspapers. You know, he really pays attention to what's in the New York Times, what's in the New York Post, what's in the Wall Street Journal. So he just takes a lot of information. And also he loves to get on the phone. You know, he loves to hit up friends.
Yeah.
You know, I think this term he's talking to a lot more sort of tech and Silicon Valley people than New York business people. But he just, you know, old friends. So you never know exactly where this information is coming from. But that could have come. He might have seen an article in The Washington Post and had a reaction to it and put it on.
In fact, they haven't landed this
this
stadium yet. Well, you know, he's talking to Howard Lutnick a lot.
Yeah.
This story in The New Yorker is something. From Money Talks, a 10-page profile, they're talking on the phone, Nancy, every night when after, by the way, Howard Lutnick gets into bed. They get on the phone together. He said they talk about real stuff like tariffs. They talk about nothing, which he described as, quote, sporting events. People you'd like to have dinner with. What was this guy like? Can you believe what this guy did? And to your point, what's the TV like? I saw this on TV. What did you think of what that guy said on TV? It really kind of brings you this down to the same guy who was meeting Elon Musk for ice cream in the White House late at night. What is that side of Trump?
Well, Trump has like never been a great sleeper. And so, you
that's
know, for
one answer.
I know. And so for some reporting I did for a big piece we did on his first 100 days, you know, I was told, for instance, in the middle of the night when he can't sleep, he has started listening to podcasts.
How about that?
I know. And so he's been listening to podcasts.
Does he put the earbuds in?
I mean, I'm not there with him.
Fantastic.
But I was just told, you know, he's become an avid podcast listener.
That is is fantastic.
And has been listening to historical podcasts.
Okay.
And so that's like another thing that's added to his social media diet. But he's always been someone who doesn't need a ton of sleep.
Sure.
You know, he's always been someone, you remember from the first term, who was like up tweeting at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
This is his vibe.
But also someone who likes the kibitz.
He does. He
likes
loves the
phone
kibitz.
Call. Hey, are you in bed? I'm in bed too. What you see on TV today? It's absolutely a great read.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Live from Washington with our eyes on a couple of stories today, including one that is now just developing with Fox News reporting that there is a criminal referral for the chair of the Federal Reserve, Representative Ana Paulina Luna, the Republican from Florida, putting forth this paperwork accusing Jay Powell of lying in two specific instances in congressional testimony, lying under oath, of course, talking about the renovations at the Federal Reserve building that are underway right now that has become a bit of a controversy as the White House looks for ways to close in when it comes to Jay Powell. The president, of course, frequently mentioning his desire to fire Jay Powell. The grounds through which he may fire him on may well include this, according to Ana Paulina Luna. But this is also against the backdrop of a very chaotic time at the White House. A week from Friday is the deadline for tariffs, August 1st. We're still waiting for a number of trade deals to be announced, as we've heard from the Treasury Secretary, the Commerce Secretary, and the President himself. And much of it as well against the backdrop of a scandal involving Jeffrey Epstein, with more than two dozen social media posts last evening by President Trump alone, in which he was not only celebrating the six-month anniversary of his new term, but also putting forth videos, for instance, of former President Barack Obama, an AI video of him being arrested in the Oval Office. We want to cut through the noise here for you and get to the actual news beyond the distractions with the help of Tyler Kendall. Bloomberg's Washington correspondent is on the North Lawn of the White House right now. Tyler, what's happening in that building behind you today?
Yeah, hey, Joe. Well, it's hard to know where to start. You did a really great outline there that there's a lot vying for perhaps the attention economy, if we could call it that, when it comes to where the White House actually wants to focus. You mentioned the trade deals, of course. This Friday will mark that one-week mark until August 1st, and at this point, the White House hasn't given us any indication that they're going to let up on that date. Our eyes are really focused when it comes to the European Union, which has yet to get this decisive breakthrough, but it is our understanding that EU officials are really trying to ramp up the pressure and work towards a deal because they have prepared some retaliation to go into effect if they are unable to reach a end zone when it comes to this negotiation. They, of course, are facing a 30% tariff that is higher than the 50% tariff, but still incredibly high. And our reporting indicates that in these talks, the U.S. is pushing for perhaps a baseline tariff higher than 10%, which our understanding had been the floor. Now we're seeing reports that perhaps this could end up closer to that 15% range. And this would be in exchange. The EU would accept perhaps this higher baseline tariff because they're trying to get some sort of exemptions when it comes to those sector-specific tariffs, as you well know, enacted under Section 232, national security concerns, on a totally separate legal basis track. But that would be some sort of quotas when it comes to steel and aluminum, as well as auto. So we really have seen this push from the administration. They say they're still on track for a deal. We heard Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, for example, Joe, over the weekend saying that he's optimistic that they could reach one. But then the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent earlier this morning in an interview did say that they are on track, but he did allude to the fact that this is a very difficult negotiation, but he added that it doesn't have to get ugly, Joe, in his words.
Yeah, interesting to see him out on TV this morning. What do we make about this referral from Representative Ana Paulina Luna? If anything, Tyler, I realize this isn't a White House story, but the president has kind of oscillated between these threats to fire Jay Powell and then recently saying he had no plans to do that. Remembering last summer, he told Bloomberg he wasn't going to fire the Fed chair. But when you hear a story like this, it makes you wonder.
Well, definitely. And one of my top questions to the Congresswoman would be whether or not she is working in tangent with the administration, because we really have seen this targeted pressure campaign. There's two important points of context to this. One is that we actually were expecting this. The Congresswoman had indicated last week that she likely was going to do this. And second, what a criminal referral is, it is an official step here. She is asking the Department of Justice to look into alleged misconduct, but that does not mean that the DOJ is actually going to launch an investigation. And that's going to be very important here, whether or not this is just messaging or if we're actually going to see something tangible come out of it. Now, we do know that administration officials, including the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, have called for other sorts of investigation. Bill Pulte, the head of the agency, told Kaylee and me last week on Balance of Power that he is confident that Congress will look into this. Of course, this would this has raised scrutiny or potential that perhaps the administration is laying the legal groundwork here to remove Jay Powell, because as you well know, Joe, that is a very, very high legal bar in order to remove a Fed official. They would have to launch an investigation based on cause. But it really does seem to be adding to that growing list of criticism that this White House has for the Fed chair. Lastly, importantly, we should say that the Fed has said that Jerome Powell's testimony to Congress has only been truthful, and they have defended the renovation costs. It's our understanding that there is an inspector general that Powell has asked to look into the renovations.
Really important. Great reporting, Tyler. Thank you so much. Tyler Kendall, cutting to the chase. The real news here, that's what we try to distill every day on Balance of Power. We'll let you know what the noise is, but we'll also let you know what the policy is and the news that might, in fact, drive some decisions around here, with Anna Paulina Luna adding to the noise. But again, yes, a referral is not an official action against Jay Powell. We'll let you know if something more materializes in all of this. There is some real action that's taking place in Texas this week, and it's one of the most important political stories that you might not have heard about. A special legislative session in Texas, with Republican lawmakers now poised to redraw the state's congressional maps. It's taking place over the course of the coming week, with an effort, a goal here, to create five new districts, five new winnable seats, if you will, for Republican lawmakers. You might have actually heard about this last week when President Trump was asked about the effort in the White House driveway. Let's listen.
Five. I think we get five. And there could be some other states. We're going to get another three or four or five in addition. Texas would be the biggest one, and that'll be fine. Just a very simple redrawing. We pick up five seats. But we have a couple of other states where we'll pick up seats also.
Let's see how Kyle Condit feels about this as he looks ahead to the midterms across the valley and to the horizon. He's the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics and author of Campaign of Chaos. Kyle, it's great to have you back here on Bloomberg TV and radio, and congratulations on the book. I wonder your thoughts on this move, specifically in Texas, because there are some other states that we want to talk about here. The idea of adding five new winnable seats, Donald Trump said, could be enough for Republicans to maintain control of the House. What do you say?
Look, I mean, this happened 20 years ago in Texas. The circumstances are a little bit different, but there's no prohibition on mid-decade redistricting in Texas. And so back in 2003, after Republicans took control of state government, they redrew the previous map, which was sort of a version of it was a court-drawn map, but it was kind of really a Democratic gerrymander. This time, Republicans in Texas would be modifying their own gerrymander from earlier this decade that produced a 25-13 Republican advantage in the congressional delegation. But following the 2024 election and with the White House leaning on them, it seems possible that they can draw additional seats. And I think it looks like they're going to try. And then it's a question of what does the map look like and what's the environment next year? And do they actually realize the gains that they'd be drawing for themselves on paper?
Well, Texas is our big example here. But when you add a couple of other states, is this actually a strategy to maintain control of the House?
Yeah, it looks like it. I mean, Ohio, we already knew, was going to have to draw new maps. Ohio is a very convoluted redistricting system, and the map that's currently in place was only designed or was only allowed to be in effect for two election cycles, 2022 and 2024. Republicans are basically going to have more power over the process than they did back in 2021 and 2022. Ohio has a 10-5 Republican House delegation right now. It's possible that maybe the Republicans could get that up to 12 or even 13-2. And so that's another state to watch. You know, it's possible that other states could try to reopen redistricting. Some Democrats are thinking about trying to do that, although it's harder in those states because a lot of the states where Democrats have control of state government also has some sort of restrictions on gerrymandering or an independent commission that draws the lines. You know, Texas doesn't have that, and so it's just easy for Republicans to just reopen it in Texas. It's a lot harder in a state like California, for instance.
Let's talk about California because Governor Gavin Newsom is always waiting in the wings here. Kyle, at a moment like this, he says California, in fact, should try to counter states like Texas by redrawing its own congressional districts. Listen to what the governor said.
When Donald Trump calls in to the Texas legislature along the lines of the phone calls he made saying, find me some votes in Georgia, and says, find me more five more seats in Texas, they're playing by a different set of rules. They can't win by the traditional game, so they want to change the game. We can act taller than thou. We could sit on the sidelines, talk about the way the world should be. Or we can recognize the existential nature that is this moment.
Let's not talk about the way the world should be. Let's talk about the way it is. In 2010, voters in California approved a measure that put the job, to your point, of drawing California's congressional map into the hands of an independent commission. So what's Gavin Newsom talking about?
Well, look, I mean, it looks like California is thinking about trying to maybe go back to the voters to ask them to grant an exception. You also could maybe make a reading of California law and say that, you know, at the start of the decade, the maps are drawn by a commission, but it doesn't necessarily say anything about the middle of the decade. Again, all this stuff would end up in court if attempted.
Yes.
Republicans assert that even though Democrats have, you know, that's an independent commission in California, that is still a Democratic leaning map. And there may be some truth to that, but I think it's also true that California could have an even more lopsided delegation than it already is. It's 43-9 Democratic right now, but you could potentially draw a map where the Democrats could get an extra, you know, several number of seats out of California. But the thing is there are many more hoops to jump through for Gavin Newsom and Democrats in California than there are for Governor Greg Abbott and Republicans in Texas.
Mm-hmm. You just said something important, Kyle, and that's court. That's where all this is going, right?
Oh, yeah, I would assume any, you know, there's already an active lawsuit by Democrats and their allies over the Texas map, and there surely will be again. But, you know, these cases take forever to get sorted out. So even if there was some sort of, you know, strong legal argument to be made against the maps, maybe that isn't determined until 2028. And, you know, the White House pretty clearly is looking at this and saying, hey, how could we maximize as Republicans our chance of keeping the House in 2026, which is Trump's last midterm because he's constitutionally forbidden from running for office again in 2028. And all these moves are designed toward that goal.
Remember that vote in California 15 years ago as Arnold Schwarzenegger urged voters to terminate gerrymandering. The New York Times reminds us of this in the story that they wrote up on it. Gerrymandering has been blamed for the partisan political world that we now live in, Kyle. Not to get too big picture, but this is the root of our partisan evil, is it not?
I don't know if I'd go that far. I mean, I do think that, I mean, you know, in an ideal world, I think that, you know, Congress would create rules for redistricting that was sort of fair between the states. But the thing is that what your definition of fair might be and what my definition of fair might be could potentially differ. Mm-hmm. I will say that, mm-hmm. that, you know, you do have a situation where a lot of members are in safe seats, even in, you know, one of the things in gerrymandering is you, and this is what the current Texas map really is that you have a bunch of safe Republican seats and then you have a smaller number of safe Democratic seats to the point where very few of the actual districts are competitive in general elections. And that does maybe make members a little bit more, you know, reliant on primary voters and appealing to them as opposed to as opposed to, general election swing voters. But even if you had the, criteria for nonpartisan redistricting, you'd still have a bunch of safe seats. So, I think there's a lot of other things at play beyond gerrymandering, even though I think we could sort of agree that, drawing partisan lines for your own party's benefit, that's not something that's particularly appealing.
Kyle Connick, we just spent the better part of 3 months talking about cuts to Medicaid, cuts to SNAP, cuts to food stamps. And we've seen some pretty chippy town halls leading to the conventional wisdom that in an off year, it might be even more difficult for the party in power to maintain control of Capitol Hill, the House, and maybe even in this case, the Senate. What are you seeing as the ground shifts beneath our feet here and the impact that the president's big, beautiful bill will have on the midterm elections?
Look, it's an unpopular piece of legislation. I think at the very best, Republicans, won't suffer because of it. And I think it's possible they will suffer because of it. It's hard to find examples from history of, a party passing a big kind of one party piece of legislation and then, benefiting from it in the next election, in the next midterm. I think we've seen throughout 2025 that there's been, a handful of special elections here and there. And it kind of feels like 2017 did in that, the Democrats are sort of more engaged, that there was sort of the usual forces kind of working against the White House party. I think what's interesting about this potential gerrymander in Texas and some of the ripple effects of it is that it would open the possibility that there could, in fact, be a big wave against the Republicans next year, and that, for the Democrats to win the House popular vote by several points, but Republicans might still be able to hold on the House because of new gerrymanders. So that throws the House, into a little bit more uncertainty.
This is why this could be fun stuff to talk about this far out. We've only got a minute left, Kyle, but I'm curious if we should be reading into fundraising yet. The NRCC outraising the DCCC in June and for all of the second quarter. Does the money matter in a world of politics like this?
I do think it matters on the margins, although, we've seen plenty of instances in recent years where, one side has a big money advantage and doesn't necessarily, that doesn't necessarily produce a victory for them. I think that, one of the things we've seen with Democrats, I think, is that, some of their fundraising may tick up, particularly as they get nominees in some of these districts that they're trying to challenge in. I think Republicans can be perfectly happy with the start they're off to in terms of fundraising. But again, I don't necessarily know if it's predictive one way or the other.
Great to have you back, Kyle. The book, again, is Campaign of Chaos. He's managing editor Sabato's Crystal Ball at UVA's Center for Politics. And a great mind when it comes to elections. We'll be talking to Kyle a lot more as we work our way through the next year. Kyle Condick on Bloomberg. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. We'll assemble our political panel next. Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis are on the way in. Bloomberg Politics contributors with the latest from Capitol Hill is straight ahead right here on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Things are about to get scarce around here in Washington. This is the last week, the House's last scheduled week before heading off on summer recess. The Senate is only set to go through next week, although Donald Trump would like them to work overtime. The president, in a series of Truth Social posts over the weekend, also calling on senators to work overtime, saying John Thune should, quote, cancel August recess and long weekends in order to get my incredible nominees confirmed, unquote. That could happen. There might be a little bit of overtime, but we're wondering what kind of legislation could still come out of this Congress, if anything, now that the rescissions bill has passed, the crypto legislation has been signed into law by the president, and we turn to our panel for more on this. Bloomberg Politics contributors Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis are with us. Jeannie, our Democratic analyst and senior democracy fellow with the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Rick Davis, our Republican strategist and partner at Stone Court Capital. Jeannie, maybe you have the answer here, because the conventional wisdom is, the narrative is, Democrats feel burned and they are not willing to play ball, that Hakeem Jeffries will sit on his hands when it comes time to write a budget for the next fiscal year. Can Congress crank out anything else from this time moving forward, including a budget for next year?
I think it's looking increasingly less likely. And it is Hakeem Jeffries. It's also Chuck Schumer. And, you know, one of the things, of the many things that happened in just the last few days, was the OMB director, Russ Vogt, saying that the process should be less bipartisan. And that is just another nail in the coffin, if you will. And Democrats feel, and I think rightly so, that what is the point of them negotiating these appropriations bills if they don't have assurance that it's going to be a bipartisan process, and if they don't have assurance that once they get these bills through, that they won't be clawed back. They warned Republicans about this with the rescission package passed last week, and they are getting no assurances on that. So I think that is going to make this process something that I will be surprised if we see them negotiate these bills. I think we are headed towards a attempt at a CR and possibly, unfortunately, a shutdown unless Republicans get together, take back the power of Congress to legislate, the power of the purse that they own, and to do it in a bipartisan manner and not hang the threat of rescissions over their heads once they pass a bill.
Everybody's talking about a shutdown already, Rick. We were getting into this last week ahead of the rescissions package passing. Is that the right conversation to be having right now? What are your appropriations friends telling you when it's time to get Democrats on the phone?
Well, I mean, there have been a number of successful appropriations bills get through committee. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would think right now it seems business as usual, okay, which usually means passage of these bills, all 12 appropriations bills, by wide margins on the floor of the Senate, mm-hmm. 67, 84 votes in order to get those things done typically. They're not seen as partisan bills. That being said, we haven't had a rescissions package in a while, and yeah, it'll be interesting to see the timing. I mean, when does the next rescission bill get submitted from the White House to Congress? Because that could be what pushes Democrats over the edge. Yes. And if Democrats say, hey, we're done, we're not going to participate in the appropriations process, and some of them have walked out of committee meetings already, mm-hmm. Then Republicans cannot legislate on their own. They can't pass a CR.
Yeah.
They can't pass appropriations bills in advance of that. And so by definition, you're into a government shutdown. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of wonder, like, what is the Democratic plan? I mean, Schumer's not indicating one way or another whether he was going to participate in any of this. And I do think the earlier clip with the governor of California saying, you know, we play by the wrong set of rules or the different set of rules. Maybe the Senate's going to start playing by their own set of rules.
Wow.
So I think there's a lot up in the air. And so I think your point, we're going to see a lot of confirmations mm-hmm. come the next 2 weeks. There are over 120
yes.
that are waiting for
big
action.
Pipeline.
I feel sorry for Senator Tim Kaine, who's going to have to come in because all the Democrats will leave.
He'll have to come
and just object.
And that is actually going to happen? Do they work overtime until they're done?
Yeah, they will process a lot of those, if not all of them, mm-hmm. Because they can. And so get rid of the backlog because they really can't get anything done on the appropriations process for a while now.
Understood. Jeannie, Rick brings up a great point. Is this, in fact, the plan that Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer have put together? Because Russ Vogt said if this first rescissions package passes, there's going to be another one, and it's going to be bigger. That sounds to me like we've stopped talking.
Absolutely, they've stopped talking. The one thing I'll disagree with is I don't think the ball is in the Democrats' court. The ball is really in the Republicans' court. If they want to do what Russ Vogt said, which is not do appropriations in a bipartisan manner, then they own this. And what we've heard from the appropriators, whether it's Murphy, whether it's Van Hollen, several others have said, the reality is we need assurances that if we are going to negotiate, you're not going to claw back. If Republicans can't give those assurances, and who knows if those would be enough, by the way, but if they can't even give those assurances, what motive do Democrats have to hand over what little power they have in this process to Republicans at this point? Chuck Schumer, let's not forget, did that in March, and he was widely, widely attacked by his own base. And I think Democrats are waking up a little slow, but waking up to the fact that Congress and the Republicans and the president have stopped playing by normal rules and procedures when it comes to Congress. They have handed over their power to the president. And why should Democrats, they feel, play a part in that? So I do think we are likely headed for a shutdown. And I do think the Democrats just have to keep asking Republicans, do you want to play ball? Give us some assurances and let's see if Republicans can do that.
Well, this goes both ways, Rick, as you've made the point. You get a line, the equivalent of a line item veto for the president of the United States. That could be a Democrat at some point. And governing by reconciliation would work for Democrats just as easily. Are we, in fact, setting a new course here for Congress?
Could be. We've been passing reconciliation bills a lot
over the last decades and CRs.
So a lot of this budgeting process, regular order, my favorite term, has kind of declined. But I would add, look, it's an optics thing, right? Who is actually shutting down government? Republicans are going to say, hey, look, out of committee, we passed all 12 of these appropriations bills. We're ready to take this vote to the floor, but we can't get Democrats to join us in passing them. Democrats will say, because you're not playing by the same set of rules. What rules? Rescission. Nobody understands what rescission is. So let's do a CR. We'll save the day with a CR. Democrats are like, no CR. What are you doing? It's rescissions. And people will say, what's a rescission? I mean, like, if I'm Johnson and Thune, and I'm sitting there having lunch trying to build legislative strategy, you know, after I'm done laughing, I think they hold all the cards.
Wow. Jeannie, I don't know if Rick needs you for this debate anymore. He just did that pretty well with both sides for us here. Does he not have a point?
He does. He has a point, but I don't think it's an effective one. The reality is people know, and particularly the Democratic base that's going to be voting in 2026, that Republicans are in charge of the legislature. They are in charge of the White House. They don't have to think about these things like rescissions. What they have to know is that Republicans are not willing to deal with Democrats. I mean, Democrats need to ask a very simple question. Can you give us assurances that if we work with you, you will not cut our feet off in the end? And if Republicans can't give that, what incentive do Democrats have to work with them? So I think it's actually the opposite of what Rick said. If Democrats just went along because they're scared of explaining what a rescission is, then they are going to lose. They have got to stand their ground for what we all know should be a regular process of appropriating that starts in the first branch, and the president doesn't have a line item veto, nor do these rescissions work. If they negotiate and he signs, that should be the law. So I think actually it's quite the opposite. And I, you know, I won't have the conversation with myself like Rick did, and I'm no comedian, but I don't think it's that complicated to explain either.
Well, you wonder if anything that's not budget related could emerge in this Congress. Rick, is there any policy in the form of legislation that could pass this body between now and the midterms? You've got some stuff out there. Steve Daines has a bill to rename the Washington football team the president was talking about over the weekend. I mean, could something exotic get through this body?
Yeah, first of all, it's been a pretty productive Congress in the first 6 months of Donald Trump's presidency. So it's not like it's in a gridlock. And there's no downside to just posting up another reconciliation bill in the fall.
Which has been promised.
Which has been done in the past. And I would remind Jeannie, I mean, Bill Clinton did rescission packages, and the world didn't come to a stop then. Now, granted, we did have a government shutdown,
right,
but that wasn't because of rescissions. And it is a rule that the president can actually have, and if he's got a Congress that'll go along with him, great. But at the end of the day, right now, I think the Republicans, to use a term that Donald Trump uses in the Oval Office all the time,
oh God,
they've got the cards.
Okay, I got a little bit nervous there. Jeannie, you know, you're talking about assurances from the other party, in your case, the Republican Party. Isn't passing a bill and signing it into law kind of the definition of an assurance? How do you get more than that?
Well, that's a question for Republicans to answer, because that's what happened. And they came back and they took back the $9 billion. And I very well remember the past rescissions policies or practices that came to the Congress. But the difference there was something that Susan Collins talked about last week, which was that came with details about what was entailed and why this money was being pulled back. There are certainly reasons to engage in a rescissions practice, but that is not what occurred in this case. And you had Republicans asking Russ Vogt for details on what was happening, why it was happening, why it was needed, none of which was responded to. And so that is what is needed, is you need a policy and practice in place where you can do these things in a way that are meaningful. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can appropriate money and pull it back, but you need to know why it's happening. It can't just be Donald Trump's whim because he wants the money.
Well, you do wonder what happens to assurances on money for those tribal stations Mike Rounds asked for. Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis, Bloomberg Politics contributors. You'll only hear right here on Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.